The following is a presentation of the Dirt Track Channel.
Well, hi there, everybody. I'm Sean Wood, and welcome to the Sprint Car Show for Tuesday, February the 4th. On today's broadcast, we'll talk with Mike O'Leary, the Public Relations Director for the King of Indiana Sprint Series. Brad Doty will join us to talk about the upcoming World of Outlaw season. And we'll talk with David Murcott, the newest Australia One, as he picked up the championship last weekend. That's all coming up next here on the Sprint Car Show, brought to you by Coastal181.com. Reading for racers by Penske Racing Shocks, the competitive advantage of champions. And by the National Sprint Car Hall of Fame and Museum, located outside of Turn 2 at the famed Knoxville Raceway. Just in time for spring, motorsports publisher Coastal 181 will deliver another great open-wheel book titled The People's Champ, A Racing Life. This autobiography of USAC Triple Crown champion Dave Darlin looks at his racing career from quarter midgets to sprint cars. The People's Champ is sure to be a hit with open-wheel fans about one of the sport's true class acts. To learn more, visit Coastal181.com or call them toll-free at 877-907-8181. Coastal 181, reading for racers.
Hi, this is Greg Hodnett. You're listening to the Sprint Car Show with Sean Wood.
And welcome back to the Sprint Car Show here on the DirtTrackChannel.com. Time to talk a little non-wing sprint car action. And we bring in the Public Relations Director for the King of Indiana Sprint Series, a longtime motorsports journalist, Mike O'Leary. Mike, great pleasure to talk with you once again. Thanks for taking time out of your busy day to join us here on the Sprint Car Show.
Sean, it's really good to talk to you again, and I'm really looking forward to these chats just because I know warmer weather's coming.
Well, you were telling me before we came on the air, it's about 23 degrees. The snow hasn't started flying yet in Indianapolis, but it's not too far away from you guys, and I'm starting to wonder if we're not going to see spring until June, unfortunately. What's your thoughts as to whether or not we're going to see the season opener push back if this cold weather continues?
I can tell you that the dates will not change. However, I'm always an optimist, and I think we're going to have excellent weather here the end of April to kick off our sprint car racing. In the King of Indiana Sprint Series, once a schedule is set, they don't adjust any of the dates for weather.
I think that might be one of the unique things about it because, as was the case last year, I was heading out to a couple different events throughout the month of May, and boy, Mother Nature did not like us last May at all, did she?
No. We had three out of our seven races got rained out last year, and as I said, they don't reschedule races or that for the KISS series. Which gave us a pretty short result, but boy, it was exciting.
Pardon the pun there. Of course, it was Brady Short that picked up the championship last year. 13th year, Mike, for the King of Indiana Sprint Series. What was the reception like back that very first year? And it hasn't grown in terms of it has seven dates, but the concept, as time has gone on, the reception that you have received from both the track, the drivers, and the fans with this King of Indiana Sprint Series?
Well, in the early years, there wasn't a whole lot known about it because it was basically just word of mouth. And the drivers and the crews and that, they loved it because it was putting a little bit more money into the purse, but nobody envisioned it lasting as long as it has or growing the way that it has. Now we have people that contact us all through the winter, trying to get the schedule, looking at what their plans are, and planning around, when they can make the KISS races.
And what do you think has been the one thing that has led to its success over the years that has now brought you into that lucky number 13 season?
I think it's just exciting non-wing sprint car racing. The cast of characters changes a little bit every year, but it has always featured the best drivers from the Midwest. We do see visitors come in every now and then that want to race with it, but fans know what to expect, and it's just going to be wheel-to-wheel racing, and that's what they love to see.
This year's season opener is April 27th at Terre Haute, and seven dates later, you guys will wrap up on May 31st at Paragon. Has the time frame for the King of Indiana Sprint Series changed over the years in the terms of how long or how short of a season you try to keep this?
It did move around a little bit early. The first few races, the first few years, the races were actually in July, and then it moved to June. However, for the last, I would say, 5-6 years, it has been consistent. Basically, the month of May and perhaps a race in late April or early June. But it's been constant now, and the promoters are really comfortable with the schedule that they've been able to put together.
With the month of May, of course, the new race, the Grand Prix of Indianapolis this year on May 10th at the Speedway, and, of course, the 500 as well. What do you see, Mike, in terms of an influx of IndyCar fans that are also open wheel fans that come on out and check out a KISS race during the month of May?
Well, we definitely see them, both fans and actually people that are involved in the IndyCar series that do come out and check out the races. And a lot of it is curiosity. They've heard of the KISS series. They've heard they have some familiarity with non-ring racing, and they want to check it out. And at that time of the year, this is probably the biggest races going on around the state is in the KISS series. So very frequently they'll come to Gas City or Bloomington or Kokomo and take a look at the races there. In other cases, they're just racing insiders and they know what they like to see, and this gives them an opportunity on a Friday or Saturday night to get out to the local track.
I think this was interesting to note the other day, and I'm going to ask you to pop off your PR hat for a second and put on your journalist hat because you've been around Indiana sports for many, many years. Kyle Larson said that he had gone to Chip Ganassi and asked him if he could drive the 500 some year. And we've looked at over the years, you have talented guys, not only like Brady Short, but John Stambro, Dave Darlan just recently getting a shot to run ARCA. The list goes on and on as to what the talent is. Brian Clausen, another kid there in Indiana. Do you think we'll ever see the day and time come when some of these IndyCar owners might take a look right in their own backyards and realize how much of a good talent crop there is there to get those kids to the 500 somewhere in the future?
That's kind of a loaded question, Sean. I'm very hopeful. I'm always very hopeful. But there are so many things involved. In the IndyCar series, you have your engine makers like Honda and Chevy that have a lot of say on who the drivers are going to be in those cars. You have others that have a lot of influence on who's selected to be those drivers. In recent years, there haven't been very many that have had tremendous success. Obviously, Eddie Carpenter's probably the biggest one sitting on the pole at Indy last year, and every year he runs up front in Indy and he wins IRL races, and he came right out of the midgets and sprint cars to go in that direction. But he's the exception because he was able to put together year after year where he was able to learn and to hone that craft, and it took him time to do that. The drivers that we see in the non-wing sprints are guys that race 4 or 5 nights a week, and this is necessary because that's how they make a living, and they really can't take time away from that in many cases to go and sit around and do practices and travel and things like that, unless they have a really significant opportunity. And Brian Clausen has done very well in the couple of races he's run. I think there's potential there, but there's a long way to go to get a person the time that they need to learn how to be good in those cars.
And Mike, how do you see the current state of non-wing racing in Indiana as we head into this 2014 season?
Well, I think that it's very strong. The tracks in Indiana seem to be doing well. They continue to open their doors every Saturday, every Friday night on their regular schedules. They continue to schedule big races, and they continue to bring in a lot of racing fans. I know in some areas of the country that there are a lot of economic challenges. However, we're really, really fortunate that it seems to be doing as well as it is in this area.
Do you see a growth then based on how things are going in Indiana with non-wing racing in the next few years?
It's hard to say that I would see a growth. I think if the economy was to improve, that we definitely would see a growth. If the economy stays the way it is or backslides, then I think the promoters and the racing people they feel fortunate just to maintain status quo and be able to keep doing what they're doing. But, you know, all of this being said, at your local short tracks, you get the best value for your entertainment dollar over almost anything else in town. And I think this is something that a lot of people recognize.
And I think that's something that also needs to be pushed more and more, because you're absolutely correct when it comes to the best entertainment dollars that you can spend on a Friday night, whether you're at Gas City or down at Bloomington. And I always have the calendar marked and circled and ready to pack up shop here in central Pennsylvania, head out to the great state of Indiana and live in Indy for the month, and not only hit the IndyCars deal, but hit all the non-wing racing events, because it's just such a different atmosphere from here in central Pennsylvania. And I love both winged and non-wing, but it is a different atmosphere. But either way you slice it, it's still great racing for the fans. We mentioned, Mike, April 27th is the opener at Terre Haute. What are some of the other dates that fans will want to pencil in and check out a King of Indiana Sprint Series when they can?
Well, let me just run through the schedule really quickly. It's every weekend after that. May 2nd and May 4th, which is Friday and Sunday, they're going to be at Bloomington and then the Kokomo Speedway. The weekend after that, May 9th at Gas City I-69 Speedway on Friday. The following weekend, they go down to Lawrenceburg Speedway on May 17th. The weekend after that, right after the Indy 500, down at Tri-State Speedway in Hobstadt. That's on May 25th. And then the last day of May, the 31st, at Paragon Speedway. As you mentioned, that's going to be the finale.
I wonder if I can somehow rent a helicopter and fly down from covering the 500 and get down to that race at Tri-State, because Tri-State's one of the tracks, sad to say, I have not been to yet. And I'm just wondering if that double can be done. What do you think?
Well, I know it can, because I've done it every year. And what you need to do is just position your car to get out the gate as quick as you can, get into the traffic, and head over to catch, head out I-70 to I-69, take I-69 south to Hobstadt, and you're there in time for hot laps.
Is that the other version of the Indy 500, doing the Indy 500 speed limit from Hobstadt, from Indy down to Hobstadt?
Well, yeah, it would be beneficial to invest in a good radar detector.
Either that, or I'll be putting money into the economy and helping out the state itself with a rather large ticket.
There you go. But it would be worth it, Sean. You know that.
Oh, yes. Yes, I do. I just have to figure out how to make that happen one of these years. But, Mike, as always, we greatly appreciate you taking out time. I know you're a very busy person with your job, and so we thank you for that. Folks, you can also catch Mike in Speed Sport News and Sprint Car and Midget Magazine with his columns, and he's been around a long time writing and covering both the IndyCars and the dirt track racing scene in Indiana. And, of course, the King of Indiana Sprint Series opener April the 12th at the Terre Haute Action Track. Mike, here's wishing that it's a safe season for the KISS Series, free of rain, and that you have an incredible race on the 31st to determine your champion on the very last lap of of that feature event.
Sean, I definitely appreciate that, and I'm looking forward to it. And if I can just take one more second, I'd like to mention our website, which is kissracing.com, and you'll find all the information, all the results on our website as they need.
Thanks, Mike, again. Appreciate your time. We look forward to having you back on the show in the future talking about the King of Indiana Sprint Series.
Sean, thanks for all your help, and it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. Mike O'Leary, the Public Relations Director for the King of Indiana Sprint Series, joining us here on the Sprint Car Show. We will take a break and be back with more right after this.
The National Sprint Car Hall of Fame and Museum in Knoxville, Iowa, is the only sprint car museum in the world dedicated to promoting the future of sprint car racing and preserving the past. Located in Turn 2 of the world-famous Knoxville Raceway, the National Sprint Car Hall of Fame and Museum is open 7 days a week, year-round, except New Year's Day, Easter, Thanksgiving Day, and Christmas Day. Non-wing sprint cars, historic big cars, open-wheel roadsters, and wing sprinters are all on display in the museum, which also features a movie theater and the National Sprint Car Hall of Fame. Make plans now to stop by the National Sprint Car Hall of Fame and Museum the next time you're in Knoxville, Iowa, or shop our museum store online at www.sprintcarstuff.com. The Hall of Fame and Museum is open from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Central Time Monday through Friday, and from noon to 5 p.m. Central Time on Saturdays and Sundays.
Hi, this is Shane Cottle. You're listening to the Sprint Car Show with Sean Wood.
And welcome back to the Sprint Car Show here on the DirtTrackChannel.com. We continue on now. Last week we had on Brian Carter from the World of Outlaws talking about the upcoming season and about the races here in Central Pennsylvania, including the first time in 10 years the Outlaws will be coming to Port Royal. A man who knows about racing in Central Pennsylvania, not only as a driver, but also as a television commentator, the color analyst for the television broadcast for the World of Outlaws, Brad Doty, joins us on the line right now. Brad, it's always a great pleasure to talk with you. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks again for having me on.
Sure thing. Well, I'll tell you one thing, the rate we're going right now, I'm not sure if we're going to see spring until June. And that groundhog may be in a bit of trouble, but it's always good to talk sprint car racing with you right now. Your days of racing through Central Pennsylvania, of course, you raced against guys like Keith Kaufman and Fred Raymer. And I want to ask you right up front, with those two guys retiring last year, how big of a loss for the sport is that when the caliber of those two guys actually retire in the same year?
Oh, it's big. There's no doubt about it. I mean, they've got a huge following and have for years. But we all have to face the fact that drivers have come and gone for generations. And thankfully, the sport has survived. And it's going to survive without them. And they're well aware of that, I'm sure. It's just part of this racing, but they're going to be missed. There's no doubt about it. I mean, anytime those guys showed up at the racetrack, they were going to be the guys to beat, and they had a fan following, and father, son, daughter, generations came to watch those guys, they're definitely going to be missed. I know Fred's going to stay involved, as you well know, in the sport as a car owner for his sons, and I don't know what Keith Kaufman's plans are, but living so close to Port Royal, I'd like to think that he's going to show up every now and then, and the fans are still going to get to see him around the racetrack.
I think he will. It's one of those ones where over the years I've heard that there are certain drivers that once they retire, they just don't go back to the racetrack. But there are others that are like a Lynn Paxton that are completely involved to this day, both with the Eastern Motorsports Museum and with Williams Grove. Speaking of Williams Grove, hard to believe it is 75 years old this year. What are some of your fondest memories of racing at the Grove?
Oh, gosh. One that pops to mind, I guess, I showed up in Gary Stanton's car. I was driving for Gary, and we'd been struggling a little bit, and we actually had a cylinder that was oiling, and we had to put a hotter spark plug in that cylinder. And Gary flew out that day, and I pleaded with him to let me go to the Grove. And I pulled in to the Grove that day by myself, towing the rig, and Deuce Terrell happened to be not working for anyone at the time, and he helped me get the car out and put the wing on it and fuel it and put tires on it and stuff like that. And if I remember right, because being an outsider, I had to start about mid-pack, but we got on the cushion and rough and choppy up there and won that thing in Gary's car. And that obviously would be a fond memory. And one not so fond is when I led a 29 and three quarters laps for a World of Outlaws race, and Steve put a big slider on me, and I spun trying to get back under him and spun the car out. But that's part of racing, right? You're going to lose a lot more than you're going to win.
Well, speaking of Steve, of course, Steve Kinzer, that is, Steve announcing that 2014 was going to be his final season of chasing a points championship, your initial reaction when you heard this was going to be the last year he was going to go after a title?
Well, I just turned in my latest Sprint Car Midget column about this, and I guess, you know, to answer your question, we all knew it had to happen sooner or later. And, you know, it's kind of like we talked with Fred and Keith. I mean, time catches up with all of us, and he's going to be – Steve's going to be missed tremendously by a lot of fans all over the country. And but will the World Outlaws survive? Definitely they will. I'm hoping the same thing, that Steve can stay involved with, you know, the car owner to Craig, or in some form that he's visible at the racetrack and still part of the World of Outlaws. But, you know, I'm glad for him, I guess. I've seen him get a little emotional when he talks about it. You know, you don't see that kind of emotion out of Steve very often, and it just shows what this sport means to him and how deeply sprint car racing is ingrained in him and part of him.
What do you think, outside of his legacy, what was the one tangible that always stood out about Steve Kinser that made him who he was, both on and off the track?
Just the brute strength that he had, the upper body brute strength that he had. You know, he state champion wrestler, but his mindset also. I mean, mentally, he was about as tough, if not tougher, than he was physically. And boy, you put those two traits together, and that's why he was so unstoppable in my mind for so many years. I mean, if he didn't, you know, couldn't outsmart us or mentally be tougher than most of us, he definitely, you know, was physically still tough the last 5 or 10 laps. And everybody knows Steve Kinser. A lot of times he didn't, worry too much about working out or staying in shape. It was just a God-given natural gift that he had, that he was so strong up with his upper body.
Any good Steve Kinser story that you can relay outside of the one where you just said a moment ago you lost trying to get back underneath them coming off of turn 4 at the Grove?
Oh, there's a lot of them I can't say, but he would rather I not say. I'll put it that way. I guess one thing that we both had sponsored from Coors, both sponsored by Coors Light, and now just to set the record straight, we weren't teammates. Markson Kepler owned my car, and Carl Kinser owned Steve's. They both happened to be Gambler chassis, and the sponsorship went through Gambler, but we were both had the Coors Light sponsorship, and I talk about this in my book as well, so those that read it, it's an old story, but we were racing one night and kind of got to banging wheels with each other, and I didn't like Steve chop. I felt like Steve chopped me pretty bad, and he obviously felt that I squeezed him out, so a caution came out. We're kind of banging wheels and flipping each other off and shaking our fists at each other, and he wins the race and I run second, and we had to get up on a tractor trailer rig for big victory lane celebration, and we're kind of up there in each other's face. We both have Coors Light uniforms on, and the race happened to be sponsored by Coors Light, and some of the Coors Light reps were there, and it was a big deal, and we both kind of realized where we're at, I think, and calmed down a little bit. But that was interesting that it was such a big Coors Light night, and here the two kind of teammates going at it. So that was probably the worst time that we've ever had.
What do you remember about Steve the first days you met him? And what was he like back in those early days?
Gosh, it's amazing, isn't it? Because, and again, my latest column just came out, Sprint Car Midget, was about him and meeting him for the first time. It's ironic, but it was at running East Bay in Florida, and I passed him in hot laps, and I thought I was king of the world because I passed Steve Kinser. Now, this would have been like 1981, so the Outlaws were only, you know, had been in existence for going into the third year, so... I mean, Steve's legacy even then, I mean, he was the guy to beat. Him and Carl were the guy to beat. You know, he won the first Outlaws Championship in 78. But anyway, yeah, he was the guy, everybody, he had the bullseye and he wanted to beat. And I passed him in hot laps. And we later ended up at the Bullfrog Lounge, which was the place where all the drivers hung out. And got to talking to him there. And actually, he talked to me first. That's a fond memory that, you know, that he actually, you know, asked me where I raced and how, you know, where I'd come from, that kind of thing, and so I felt pretty proud that I got his attention.
Yeah, that is pretty darn interesting.
Yeah.
Well, you know, looking back on last year, Darren Pittman did something that I think if you had asked any knowledgeable sprint car fan, they probably would have said a Steve Kinser or a Sammy Swindell, not sliding Darren at all, might have been the first driver to do this, but Pittman goes wire to wire from the first day of the season to the last day, leading the points. Your thoughts on just how difficult that was to accomplish, giving all the great drivers, including yourself, that have ever competed on a regular basis with the World of Outlaws?
Unbelievable is the only word you can to describe that. I mean, for him to be away from the World of Outlaws for 4 years and wanting to always get back to it and to come back and to do that, just, again, it's unbelievable. To win the first race and to have the dream season that he had, it's every driver's dream. I mean, that is literally a dream come true.
And the other thing, too, you look at it, here's Darren getting this big lead, and then all of a sudden, the month of July and August roll around, and the Knoxville Nationals are upon us, and lo and behold, Donnie Schatz, here he comes, and he's making a hard charge, but he doesn't pull off the charge this year and ends up finishing in second. What do you think, in your own opinion, was the difference in Donnie this year not making that late season charge to win a championship compared to what he's done in the past other years when he's won a championship and made that run from Knoxville on out?
Well, he basically did do that all year. I mean, he's, 23 total wins, but the big difference, he had four DNFs and Darren Pittman only had one, and that goes back to Pittman's dream season. And I tried to put this into words in one of my columns, too, and it's hard to put into, written word. There's been a lot said about the point structure with the World of Outlaws and the bonus points that Darren got, and basically it wasn't fair and on and on and on. And Donnie even made the comment in Charlotte, we didn't get outran, we got outqualified. Well, he's admitted later he's won championships with consistency, and he's won championships by winning the most races. And it is what it is. The point structure, if Donnie wouldn't have had those three more DNFs, he would have been out front. Excuse me. He would have been out front in the points anyway. So those, the bonus points that Darren got wouldn't even come into play. But Joey Saldana is another good example, who won 21. He had two seasons of over 20 wins himself and didn't win the championship. So for people to say, oh, there's something wrong with the system when, Donnie wins 23 and Darren only won 8, I don't quite agree with that. It's been the same structure. And I definitely think the guy that wins races should be rewarded, don't get me wrong. But under the system that it is, I don't think it needs a major fix, I guess, put it that way.
Well, obviously NASCAR thinks they need a major fix in their own point system, but I guess it's the old saying, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So you then like the current structure that is being used by the Outlaws for the point system?
Well, I guess I wouldn't go so far as to say that. I don't put a lot of thought into it, I guess, one way or the other, because I'm not a competitor anymore. But as long as it's the same for everybody, how can anyone say it's unfair? You all play by the same rules. I don't like a lot of emphasis on qualifying, like the Knoxville Nationals, to have the points, the same points for qualifying. It forces owners into spending a ton of money on engines to get those two laps of qualifying. But the Outlaw deal, it's a little bit different because they invert the heat races. So, they're kind of awarding the points to discourage sandbagging for one, but to give you a little bonus for having to be inverted, so in a heat race. So, all in all, it's been working. It could be better. I'm sure it could be. Am I the guy to change the structure? Nope.
No, but you might have material for another column in Sprint Car Midget Magazine.
There you go. Yeah. Have to keep that in mind.
We're talking with Brad Doty here on the Sprint Car Show on the DirtTrackChannel.com. Well, Brad, this year I want to take a two-pronged look at it. Number one, of the 88 races, there are 11 in Central Pennsylvania, which is a big number, as the road to Charlotte really leads through Pennsylvania if you're going to win a championship. And the other thing, speaking of Pennsylvania, Bobby Allen, Scruffy, he's returning to the Outlaw Trail with his grandson, Logan Shuart, and his son, Jacob Allen. Just want to get your thoughts on having those guys with the Outlaws this year, but also your thoughts on the importance of a team to come through relatively unscathed in Central Pennsylvania if they want to have a shot at the championship come the weekend in Charlotte.
Yeah, I think that having kind of like we talked with Steve and Raymer being involved and whatever Keith decides to do, but having Bobby Allen, you know, out with the World of Outlaws as a car owner, that's going to be great for the series. There's going to be a ton of fans around the country that were big fans of his that are going to enjoy seeing him again. So that's obviously the big plus for the series. I'm hoping that they can start out well in Florida. And, I mean, they've said it themselves. They almost have to do well in Florida, and then go all the way to California to get the tow money and provisionals after California kind of thing and financially be set. It'd be disastrous if they went to Florida and tore up some cars or blew several engines. So, you know, the key is for them to get through Florida and the West Coast swing pretty in good shape. And that's what we'll all keep our eye on.
And what about coming through Central Pennsylvania? 11 races of the 88 are here in Central Pennsylvania, even, and I'm including the two out at Lernerville. How important is it in that stretch there for an outlaw driver to come out relatively unscathed with any kind of either a DNF or a loss of an engine because of the big tracks like the Port Royals, the Grove? How important is that if a driver wants a shot at the championship?
Well, that's key. I mean, that's every driver worries about that. You know, being a PA Posse member living right there, you know how tough it is for the Outlaws to come in to that part of the country and win races. And not only to win races, but just make the show. And we talked about, you know, Bobby Allen was, you know, getting through Florida and California, get provisionals and get on the tow money. The drivers, when they come to Pennsylvania, better have some provisionals because it's so tough. We've seen it happen before. If you're out of provisionals, that is the area that you could see yourself sitting on the top of the trailer watching the guy in the points that you're battling with just take over because it's so easy to miss the show there that, you know, especially adding more races to that area. It's definitely going to be tough. The champion will have to do well going through Pennsylvania.
Well, Brad, as always, we appreciate you taking time out to join us here. I know we're chatting as the snow continues to fall and pile up all over the place. I'm wondering if the groundhog is right this year. Just how many more enemies he's made.
it's been a long winter for a lot of us, that's for sure. And ready to get some racing. The racing season underway here.
Brad, we always appreciate your time and look forward to having you back on throughout the rest of the 2014 season here talking about the World of Outlaws.
All right. Well, thanks again for having me on.
Sure thing. Brad Doty joining us here on the Sprint Car Show. We will take a break and be back with more of our show right after this.
The world leader in suspension technology, Penske Racing Shocks has been providing custom-built, high-performance shock absorbers to all forms of racing for over 20 years. Offering only the highest quality suspension products, shocks are available in non, single, double, triple, and four-way adjustable configurations. All Penske Racing Shocks are hand-built, tailored to meet a driver's feel or car setup, and dyno-tested, ensuring the highest attention is paid to detail, consistency, and performance. For your short track needs, contact Dave Reedy at Penske Shocks at 610-375-6180. That's 610-375-6180. Penske Racing Shocks are available direct from the manufacturer or through many dealers worldwide. Visit them on the web at www.penskeshocks.com. Penske Racing Shocks, the competitive advantage of champions.
Hi, this is Bad Chad Layton. You're listening to the Sprint Car Show with Sean Wood.
Welcome back to the Sprint Car Show here on the DirtTrackChannel.com. Well, if you're checking our Dirt Track Channel Facebook page and saw it around 3:30 in the morning this past Saturday, you know we were one of maybe the few people on the east coast of the U.S. who were up watching the live stream of the Australian Sprint Car Championship from La Trobe Speedway in Tasmania, one of the more picturesque places in the world. And joining us right now is the new Australia One, the winner of Saturday night's feature event. David Murcott is on the line with us. David, great pleasure to talk with you, and congratulations on the win and getting that Australia One on the wing and on the tail tank.
Thanks very much for that. Really appreciate it. Great to finally get it.
It's been a few days, and we'll get into the race in just a moment or two, but has it sunk in that you'll be getting that number one on your tank here in the near future?
I'll tell you what, it's still feeling a little surreal. You know, look, we've been, you know, trying pretty hard to get one of these, get the Australia One for a few years now, and, you know, I know we've won it, but it still hasn't really sunk in. I guess it will in the next day or two. Hopefully, we're having the decals changed on the race car tomorrow. We'll get the number one on the tail tank and up on the top wing. So probably when I see that, I think it'll hopefully finally sink in.
I bet as a driver, that's got to be a very special moment to be able to walk in and see them changing that number and see that number one up there and knowing what it signified, because it's so different racing for sprint cars in your neck of the woods in Australia, only in the terms of the way the championships are done compared to our season-long championship. This is one night, and you got to get everything right. Take me through the evening from hot laps through the race itself. How did you feel going into Saturday night?
We felt pretty good, actually. We had a pretty good preliminary night. They do this race over two nights, and actually have three heat races on the first night, and they carry points from that through to the first night day main, all of which you get points from to start you go towards starting positions in the A main on the last night. So we had a pretty hectic first night, but we ended up passing Ian Madsen to win the first night's A main on the last lap, going down the back straight. So we got the win there, and the car felt really good, and we're rolling around the track pretty nice. So going into the last night, we had, hot laps, one final remaining heat race, and then which we won that heat as well. So we lined up on the front row for the feature, and, we're pretty confident. But the way the track was, I knew, I guess, it was going to take rubber eventually. So for me, to lead the race early was going to be, sort of a premium, I guess, because probably as most of you guys know, when it goes rubber down, it's hard to pass, so the best place to be is out front.
This race, for folks who didn't know, the feature was 40 laps, and it did take rubber. David, from a driver's standpoint, what lap did you feel the track actually started taking rubber?
So I think it was about 15 laps in, maybe. I was running around the top on the cushion, and we're in lap traffic. And sometimes you can just tell when you're leading the race. You look at the cars that you are catching at some stage, and then you're not catching as quickly. You think there's obviously something going on down there. So for a few laps, I'll try moving down a little bit, and then probably about two laps after I first tried, I felt the rubber there. Stay there for now, if you miss it, if you miss it for a few laps, and somebody else gets it, they're gonna smoke straight past you. So I wanted to make sure that I didn't get complacent and just keep running the same line and actually found the rubber when I needed to, which luckily for me, I did.
The first caution came with just a handful of laps to go, but I want to go back to just before that and in watching it, although they weren't showing it at the time on the video. Wade Unger and David Mills were commentating. They were saying that Madsen was starting to catch you and you got caught up behind a little bit of lap traffic. What was your thought process at that point, having led all the way, but knowing the rubber situation and what that was doing to your right rear tire? Was that just a case of a little defensive stance in terms of just waiting for an opening to get around those guys? Or was lap traffic actually holding you up and allowing Ian to close in on you?
So it was holding up, we're making pretty good pace, but, because, like I said, the rubber was only so wide, you can't really, you sort of got to wait for the lap traffic guys to make a mistake in front of you, and, what I actually had to do was they'd move up maybe half a car length, and I had to sort of stick my nose in there and let them know that I was there. And and they're actually pretty accommodating. None of the guys tried to race me back or anything. Everyone raced pretty clean. So, obviously it slowed my pace a little bit, but, I also knew that, guys catching me probably weren't going to, be able to blow right around the outside of me either, knowing that there was a rubber down track. So, and you're right, you sort of got to be mindful too of the fact that, you can't try too hard to pass these guys, because then you burn your right rear tire up even more. So it was a case of having to be, very patient, and that's a hard thing to do when you're leading a race and knowing you've got, there's probably six other guys in the field that could have won that race, and I knew one of them would be knocking on the door back there. So it was a little stressful, but, we got the job done.
How much did the stress level go up after the restart? Then you have a caution with about two laps to go, and you see a guy like Brooke Tatnall, his tire, right rear tire, was completely gone. There's another driver dropped out with a right rear tire going down. And you were telling me before we came on the air, you had the Hoosier 15 on, which wasn't the hardest of hard compounds that you have. But what was the stress level like in the cockpit there with two to go?
Yeah, I was starting to get a little worried, like I said, to those guys. And Brooke's a talented race car driver. And I knew, he would have been trying to look after his tire as well. I wasn't sure what compound what he was running. But, it's probably a little bit different for them back in the pack. They're probably trying to make positions as well. Whereas for me, basically my thought process was to, try and get in the lead and then, send everybody off when the rubber come down. So that's probably why we went a little softer than maybe everybody else did. But like I said before, track position was going to be everything when the rubber come in. So our idea was just to, try to get the lead and hold it and do the best I could to make the tyre last. When I saw those guys, there was four or five guys over two laps to go with the flat tyre sitting on the infield. I was getting a little worried, but sometimes you can tell when they get down on rubber, they start to shake a bit. And it was shaking, but it wasn't too bad yet. So I figured, I was hoping that I had I had enough left to get to the finish line.
Well, let me ask you, you were able to take off and pull away from Ian on those last two restarts. Was that a setup advantage do you think you had, or were you just trying to distance yourself while still conserving that right rear tire on those two critical restarts?
Exactly what I was trying to do was, I was trying to basically go as fast as I could, but without making sure I kept the tires underneath me. I wasn't letting them spin too much and burn up. So, we had a good setup car, and, Gleno Inglis, He's had a lot of experience. He's worked with Darren Pittman in America for a lot of years, and he was crew chief on the car. And it was actually his first Australian title win as a crew chief. So, I'm very happy for him that's happened. So, he did an excellent job all night. He gave me, he gave me the best car I possibly could, and he was just basically up to me. I had the car. I had everything to do the job. I just had to do the job myself.
What was left of the tire? Was any cord showing?
Yeah, there was basically just enough rubber left, I think, to hold air. So it had like two or three lines of cords showing. So
wow.
Yeah, we didn't have too many laps left. Maybe half a lap, I'd say, for the most.
Wow, that's pretty interesting. Now, because this is such a very important race to you as an Australian, is that one of those ones where did you keep the tire or did you put it somewhere?
We kept it. Actually, my one of the crew guys, they dismounted them off the wheels and they brought them back on the plane with them. They wanted to keep them as trophy, so it was pretty cool. Well, I get to keep a nice big gold cup, so I figure if they want a trophy too, to give them the old tires, if that's what they want, well, they can have them.
I definitely think that's one of those tires you put underneath the glass case and you put in the middle of the living room to show people, hey, this is the tire that got us through to the Australian Championship. So it's got to be a pretty neat deal. You were telling me, too, you raced in Knoxville for legendary and a great guy, Bob Trussell. What was it like to race at Knoxville for a year with Bob?
One of the most awesome experiences of my life, it's been a little while now, and it's funny you mentioned, mounting a tire underneath the glass case, because that man has exactly the same thing in his lounge room. I think it's I can't remember now whether it's the one that Wolfgang won with, or maybe Steve Kinzel won with, when he first won with. But yeah, Bob was lucky enough to get two Knoxville Nationals, and he still has the wheel and tyre mounted and sitting on his Land Rover 4. And yeah, I'll tell you what, he's one of the nicest guys I've ever met, you know. And it was a lot for me, like hanging out with your granddad for the summer, and your granddad had a race car and he let you race it. That's what that's what it was like for me, you know. It was really cool. He's got a lot of stories and he's a really cool guy, and he had his hot rods there and we'd work on the race car all day, and then he'd get his hot rod out and we'd go for cruise around the street, you know, and it's one of the best times of my life. I really enjoyed it. I can't thank him enough for letting me be a small part of his life for 6 months and race at Knoxville.
So when are you coming back to the States?
I'd like to. I say every year I'm going to come back, I race so much down here now. During our summer, we race from from the end of September through till May. I actually do have a real job as well, so get time off in the middle of our winter and come over to America is things are getting harder to do. You know, my wife and I have a little boy now as well, he's 5 and just starting school, so time to get over there is getting harder and harder. But I'll tell you what, I know a lot of people over there, and I really want to get back there at some stage, maybe definitely in the next year or two, and visit some people. And my big aim is to come to Pennsylvania. I've never been there. It's definitely on my bucket list to go and see Williamsgrave. It's a place I've always wanted to see and visit and see the races there. I watch a lot of it on TV over here. Get to see the National Open on pay TV down here. So I'd really, really love to go and see that.
Well, you got to come over and race here with us because we got some great tracks as well. See Winds Grove, Williams Grove, Port Royal, Lincoln. So hopefully you can come over being a spectator, but at the same time come over and race. Now, the little lad, 5 years old, is he into the quarter midget yet, or is the missus going to let him race?
he's more into ball sports at the minute. He's into our Aussie rules football.
Good boy.
And he's quite interested in tennis too. He's actually not bad behind a tennis racket. So maybe he can keep going with the tennis, and he can look after his dad when he's making $10 million a year on the pro circuit.
There you go. Now have you taught him the ABCs? That's anybody but Collingwood.
No, I haven't. He's been trying to decide which team he likes. Mum goes for the Geelong Cats, and I go for the Western Bulldogs. And he's floating between those two. And he said, Dad, maybe I could go for Collingwood. And I said, you can go for any team in the AFL apart from Collingwood. Otherwise, you have to find somewhere else to live.
Spoken like a smart person. Hey, speaking of Geelong and the boys out there, the West Coast, Bunbury is the 2015 Australian Sprint Car Championship track. For those of us who have never been to Bunbury, what type of track is like that? And can you tell us what the difference is between Bunbury and Latrobe Speedway, where you just recently won the Australia One title?
Bunbury and a lot of the tracks in Western Australia are probably more similar to your tracks that you have in America. Mostly on the East Coast, the small quarters, I guess it's kind of like, if you know any of the tracks in California, they're small quarter miles.
Chico Silver Dollar, that type?
Very similar. But Bunbury's more like they're like 3/8, maybe a little bit bigger, and they're more flowing and very similar to the American-style tracks. So,
okay.
For us coming from the East Coast, it's a little bit more tricky like that. The local guys, I guess it's probably a lot like for you guys when the travelers come to Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
You guys race on the Pennsylvanians race on their tracks and they're really good there. Whereas, us guys that travel over there and don't race that much, it takes us a little while to become accustomed to the specifics of those tracks. But I've done a bit of racing at Bunbury when we did the World Series Tour we did 3 years in a row. We missed it last year and this year, but so we get to race at Bunbury every year, and I really enjoy racing there. We had maybe a couple of top fives there in World Series. So actually, I ran second in one of the races there a few years ago. So we've had some success there. But I think Well, at least for us, you know, I spoke to my car owner after winning the title, and he says, I guess I like it or not, we're going to Western Australia next year to defend it. So at least he's keen to go, so that's good for me.
Well, you heard it here first, folks. The guy who won the Australia title will be defending it next year at Bunbury in Western Australia, talking with David Murcott. David, outside of Saturday's big and emotional win, how has the season been going for you?
Yeah, well, we actually had a little up and down season to start off with. We got in got in a few people's wrecks. Got in one. James McFadden actually crashed in Adelaide, and he flipped in front of me, and then I flipped trying to miss him, and seemed to go a bit like that for the first four or five races. But since the World Series tour started, and we followed the first half of it, you know, we were top 10 every night. We actually led. It was a 50 lap race in Brisbane. It's part of World Series, and Donnie Schatz was there for that. We actually led that race for the first 25 laps, and then we had a pretty good race side by side with Donnie for four or five laps, and Philly put both hands back on the steering wheel, and then took off and led the thing. But we finally got our car sorted out then, and got going pretty good. Unfortunately for us, we got in the cushion the wrong way and rolled over with a few laps to go. But we actually got our car sorted out a bit better. We're on maximum this year, where we've been on Eagles for the first three or four for the last three or four years. But it's been a bit of a change. We've changed shop programs, we've changed crew chiefs, and we've changed chassis. So, I really feel that pretty since making the Warrnambool Classic final field, we've made a step up, and I think we're going to take it up to the rest of the guys down here for the rest of the year.
David, thanks so much for taking time out here during just before your dinner hour. And we greatly appreciate it. And again, congratulations on winning your first Australian title, and the best of luck for a safe season for the remainder of 2014.
Thank you very much, Joey. I really appreciate your sentiments, and great talking to you guys. Hopefully I'll get to come out and see you one day.
That sounds great. David Murcott, the new Australia one in Australia, winning the Australian title this past weekend at La Trobe Speedway down in Tasmania, joining us here on the Sprint Car Show. We will take a break and be back with more right after this. Just in time for spring, motorsports publisher Coastal 181 will deliver another great open-wheel book titled The People's Champ, A Racing Life. This autobiography of USAC Triple Crown champion Dave Darlin looks at his racing career from quarter midgets to sprint cars. The People's Champ is sure to be a hit with open-wheel fans about one of the sport's true class acts. To learn more, visit Coastal181.com or call them toll-free at 877-907-8181. Coastal 181, reading for racers. Welcome back to the Sprint Car Show. Well, that is all the time we have for this week's podcast. Join us again on February 11th for another edition of the Sprint Car Show. And special thanks to our guests, Mike O'Leary, Brad Doty, and David Murcott, for joining us this week here on the Sprint Car Show. The Sprint Car Show has been brought to you by Coastal181.com, reading for racers, by Penske Racing Shocks, the competitive advantage of champions, and by the National Sprint Car Hall of Fame and Museum, located outside of Turn 2 at the famed Knoxville Raceway. For all of us here at the Dirt Track Channel, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Sean Wood.
This has been a presentation of the Dirt Track Channel.